Our program this week is brought to you by Music Grow Search. Music Grow Search is a music industry recruiting firm that focuses solely on executive level placements. Visit them on the web at musicgrowsearch.com. Welcome to episode number 3 of the Music Industry Forum podcast. This week, Tom speaks to composer BJ Lederman. His professional credits include jingles and soundtrack packages for countless corporate and broadcast accounts, and music for many familiar with public radio programs, including Marketplace, Weekend Edition, Car Talk, and Wait Wait Don't Tell Me. In addition, BJ has worked as a copywriter for clients as diverse as Nickelodeon, The Chris Rock Show, Fox Kids, Cartoon Network, and the Christian Broadcasting Network. Visitors to BJ's website can stop by his recording studio to hear tracks as they are being laid down, suggest material to be added, and to have a glimpse into his creative process. Visit his website at bjlederman.com. Enjoy the program.
Well, BJ, let's get started. Tell us, how did you get your start in the music business way back when?
In the music business, let's see. My mother had a good friend who was a singer, and the singer wanted to get into the business or the ad business or something. So this singer introduced me to a business. It was called Nautilus. It was a weight machine company, and somehow got them to acquire me to do a jingle. It was my first jingle. So I wrote this jingle, and we went up to Richmond to Alpha Audio at the time it was called. It's now Robin Thompson's business studio. It's called In Your Ear now, but it was Apple Audio. Candy Apple.
I remember Robin Thompson well. Two B's, please, and yeah. Candy Apple Red and all that stuff.
Yeah, he's fabulous, and he's still got a great career. He's going strong, and we're still good friends. We actually had a concert last year together in Hopewell, Virginia. And I'm sure, and in fact, I'll probably be playing one or two of his covers, you know, on my tour and have them on my album. But we went up to Alpha, and it was an 8-track situation then. And I looked around the studio, and it was like a boy in a candy store. And there were drums set up and keyboards lying all around. And so I just recorded. It was a very cheesy commercial. If I can dig it up, I'll give it to you. It's called Be Good to Your Body. Be good to your body. And someone would say something, ooh, sexy bod. Take care of your body. And Nautilus will be good to you. It was so cheesy. I've done more than my share of cheesy jingles. But so I played all the keyboard parts and played the drums. And this lady sang her part. And it aired, and I suddenly had in hand my first demo, and I took it around to various ad agencies in Virginia Beach and Norfolk, and got myself hired to do a number of demos, on spec. And that's when it just started clicking for me. I just had this ability to write these catchy little tunes, and before I knew it, the best and the largest of the ad agencies in town were hiring me on a regular basis to do jingles, and that lasted for a long number of years.
Very interesting. Now, you had been a musician of some sort, a composer of some sort prior to that. Tell us about that.
Well, let's see. It's it all began with the Beatles, basically. And the night that the Beatles played on Sullivan. In fact, it started before then. My father worked at a department store, and he brought home the album Meet the Beatles one day. He brought home the album Meet the Beatles from his department store. And I had a friend, my best friend, David Lively. He was a drummer. He played piano. I was a piano player who played drums. He had a set of drums. So we both went nuts over these Beatles. And I mean, literally, we would, we'd start to talk like them, and we'd go to the movies. And at first we were quite taken aback. My mother took us to see Hard Day's Night. And, the girls were screaming in there. And then the Beatles started talking. And David and I looked at each other and went, what the hell are they saying? We can't understand a word. And I said, Mom, what's going on? She said, well, that's how they talk. They're from England, and it's Liverpool. Well, and, ever since then, David and I, we tried as hard as we could to talk like this, and we even got, I even got down to John. Well, if it's all the same to you, that is. And and then George, you know, he talks a little higher and he has a hard G. So, you know, it's okay to talk like George, but that would be wrong. So we became Beatle just nuts. And we learned, we sat there and picked out, we were both going to piano lessons from the same person. Carol, actually, I was going to Carol Nuna and he was going to Walter Nuna. Walter Nuna was the director of the Virginia Beach Symphony Orchestra for many years. And I quit after a little while because I was more concerned with picking out the Beatle tunes by ear. You know, because the sheet music of the time, we had a deal. She would teach me a Beatle song, you know, and get the sheet music if I would learn one of her, you know, sonatinas or sonatas or whatever. And I was never satisfied with the arrangement of these sheet musics for the Beatles tunes. And I would say to her, no, it doesn't go like that. It goes like this. And I'd play her, you know, what I'd picked out from the record. And before long, David and myself had formed a little band called the Lively Sound Dimension. And if I can dig up a picture of this, this would be great too. It's on the bass drum, he painted in psychedelic colors, Lively Sound Dimension, and you know the initial cap spelled LSD.
Oh.
Who knew that a few years later I'd actually be sampling that drug at Virginia Tech? But picture yourself on a boat on a river. Yeah, I got the full Technicolor treatment.
Yes, you did.
Anyway, that was the beginning. We started just doing Beatles songs, and then I started writing my own tunes. The first one was a song called Old Man. I guess it was a stab at my dad. It didn't have such the vocals weren't quite nice. The lyrics weren't too nice. But it was just – and so suddenly I realized I could write songs. And I never stopped, actually.
Fantastic. Did you ever get to see the Beatles live?
If only.
Yep.
No, in fact, I have never seen a Beatle perform. I did, however, have a close encounter with a Beatle when I was recording, I don't know which arrangement, the second arrangement of Morning Edition, I think, in New York with Jim Pugh. I was walking down the hall. It was an exciting session because Paul Simon was in one room doing One Trick Pony. And I was walking down the hall to the bathroom, and I turned the corner, and George Harrison is walking in the opposite direction, and he just passes me in the hallway. And, I mean, my sphincter just froze up. I wanted to say something. I wanted to stop him. I wanted to, George, you know, thank you so much. You're the whole reason I'm doing music, and it's a Beatle. It's a bloody Beatle. And I couldn't do anything. So, he passed me, and I just stood there in the hallway.
Dumbstruck.
Dumbstruck. Just, I stood there for a minute.
Wow.
And, you know, I walked slowly to the bathroom, and in the bathroom, I forgot why the hell I was in there.
Did you walk into the bathroom?
The whole rest of the day, you know, I was ruined because my mind was nowhere near the session I was doing, you know.
I bet. BJ, tell us how your relationship with NPR started. That's how most of us know you, by the way.
Well, I was in D.C., at American University, and one of my close friends, longtime family friend, Skip Peasy, was the chief engineer at NPR, and he came to me one day and said, they're cooking up a new morning news show, and would you like to do a demo? And I said, sure. So I remember coming home to Norfolk and recording it in who is now my guitar player. His name is Ken Taco Walker. We call him Taco for some reason. He had a little studio in his backyard in a shed, and I remember owning a really cheesy keyboard called the Krumar Orchestrator. It had piano, harpsichord, bass, little cheesy string sound, and I did a four-track demo of the very theme you hear now. I gave this thing to Skip. He gave it to Jim Russell, who was the original producer of Morning Edition. And a few months out, the story gets back to me that Jim would, in their production meetings, creative meetings, Jim would say, you know, we don't have a show yet, but we have a theme. and they would play the theme. He would say, this is what we want the show to sound like, this tone.
And they've been using that for how many years now?
Next year, in November of 2009, will be the 30th anniversary of Morning Edition.
Fantastic. Well,
yeah.
That's a testimonial to your composing skills. They found the perfect piece, and they have not saw fit to change it in 30 years. That's amazing.
Well, it sure has shown me that the music I write is either, you know, the melody is, maybe people can hum the melody. I don't know what. I think that's it. But the music does have legs, I found out. And I guess that's my talent. If I can't read the stuff, at least I can write the stuff.
Well, no doubt you have. And I know you've also made other jingles for other ads. In fact, haven't you even won a Clio Award?
I have. Can I go back just a second and complete this NPR?
Oh, please.
Get into the jingles. I need to mention that the second time around, when it was time, you know, every few years, at least back then, NPR would do new arrangements of the theme just to keep it fresh. They're not doing that as often now. But for the second arrangement of Morning Edition, they put me together with New York arranger and trombonist Jim Pugh, P-U-G-H. Jim was in, he had played in the Woody Herman Band. He's on the A-list of the New York and studio session players. He's on most every Broadway cast album ever done. And he's so cool. I mean, this is how cool the guy is. Now he's been on the past three or four Steely Dan albums and is touring with Steely Dan whenever they go on tour. I mean, you cannot get cooler than that, from NPR to Steely Dan.
Yep.
So that was that's also why I'm talking to you, because at that moment, you know, I would work with Jim and send him my demos, and then basically I would appear at the recording studio, and he would have all these session greats and jazz greats, you know, Richard T. and Randy Brecker, and I mean all these people I had just heard of and been listening to their music. So I was pretty shell-shocked, and you know, I'd look through the glass, and he would count to four, and you know, orchestra out there. And I learned that it's a good thing to, you know, find people who are better than you and let them do their thing. And I have NPR to thank for that observation. And so since then, you know, Jim took my music from a little kernel, you know, little innocent musical thought to a full-fledged, polished, beautiful production. You know, Jim, when we say arranger, I really have to say arrangers are writers. You know, they are writing an original version of your piece and making it better. And ever since then, you know, all my if not all of my NPR stuff has been arranged by Jim Pugh.
Sounds like a good one to have on your team for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Well, back to your advertising work. A moment ago, I asked you about your Clio Award. Who was that for?
The Clio was for a regional breakfast meat company called Gwaltney, G-W-A-L-T-N-E-Y, of Smithfield. They made bacon and sausage and whatever. And that was during the time when I was working for the biggest and best ad agencies in the area. This was Lawler Ballard and Associates. And they had me in. They showed me the video, the storyboard of what they were doing. It was a TV commercial. And it was basically a trip down memory lane from the early days of how breakfast was made. And so the music started with some, you know, early honky-tonky type stuff, you know, music you would associate with, you know, Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin, to Roaring Twenties. You know, breakfast was now a little more hip, a little more modern, and then they flashed to today, and, you know, when then we had a whole orchestra come in. And that was the one that won a Clio, my first Clio award. I have to tell you, there were other jingles that could have won comedy awards, and one that comes into mind. God, it's a dairy company. It just occurred to me, man, I'm all over breakfast. The meal I rarely ever see. The one meal I rarely see is where I – anyway, this was for Marva-Made Dairy. And it started with William Tell Overture. And anyway, somewhere in this jingle was a – I can't even say it with a straight face. The singers would sing – ooh, Marva-Made. And then a cow would go, moo, Marva-Made. Best from us to you, or something like that. Marva-Made.
Fascinating history of you in the music industry. BJ, tell us, what kind of current projects are you working on, and what's next for you?
Well, a couple of years ago, I realized that NPR was headed toward this 30th anniversary of Morning Edition. And for some reason, all of my friends have CDs out. I mean, everybody's got a CD. I don't have a CD. And I said, you know, there's, if you don't get to off your ass and record a CD in the next, you know, year or so and get on the road and, you know, sell it to these 10 million or so listeners, or the portion of which I've always thought was there and would sort of come out to see me or buy an album just out of curiosity, then I would be an idiot if I didn't do that. So I'm in a transition now. It's the BJ Lederman transition team, sort of a breakout mode to break me out of the background music scene to the foreground music scene. And I'm called the musical clown prince of news, pop culture, and rock and roll. And I sort of had this, you know, no one knows who I am or what I sound like or what my beliefs or thoughts are. And they just hear this nice, you know, polished background music. So I've got this interesting niche in the market. But when you see me play, if you come out to a gig and see me with the band, I mean, I'm more or less would remind you of a cross between, say, a hip Mark Russell, George Carlin, John Lennon, with a little Groucho Marx thrown in. And that's what my album's going to be. So now I am writing songs. I am also culling other songs from a great mass of cover tunes that my friends have written. And I will soon be starting recording what will either be called Life at the Bottom of the Dial or something that cannot be said on any media.
BJ, tell me what History 911 is and what prompted you to write this fascinating song.
I think I have George W. Bush to thank for the song, sadly. I've been an activist most of my life, but mainly in terms of writing letters to the editor. back in At Virginia Tech, I remember protesting against Nixon in the Vietnam War, but doing stupid things like hanging sheets out my window with nasty things written on them about the President Nixon and streaking. We were part of the first streaking team at Virginia Tech, streaking through McDonald's, you know, to protest the war and stuff. But when George W. Bush took us into Iraq, I smelled a fish. And I'm a little more, you know, I have a little more time than the average Joe to dig in to the news in depth, especially with the internet. You know, I don't just read the local paper and watch the local news and the 30 minutes of national news. I dig pretty deep, and I read, you know, read books by the, you know, people from the administration, ex-administration, this, that, and the other. But back then, before we invaded, I said, this is going to be another Vietnam. You know, and everybody else was saying, no, it's not going to be anything like Vietnam. It's a different time, a different landscape. And I'm just thinking, well, yeah, a different landscape, but it's still a landscape that we are unfamiliar with as far as fighting in. And by the way, you haven't convinced me that you have worked hard enough, President Bush, with the world community in the UN or whatever, to find these so-called weapons of mass destruction. You have not worked hard enough to connect the dots between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. And I would, you know, I blame us. I blame the American people, or the what I think are the majority of the American people, who have been fooled by this man and have allowed themselves to be fooled by not questioning him because of so-called patriotism. I'm a big believer that, you know, dissent is one of the foundations of patriotism. And however, I live in a town, a Navy town, Virginia Beach in Norfolk, and it's not so easy to, well, you feel it anyway, that it's not so easy to express your dissent here. Any dissent is viewed as being against the troops. And, you know, you see these bumper stickers that say support the troops. And I'm thinking, you know, you're not seeing the forest for the trees. This is ridiculous. I'm supporting the troops by being vocal enough to try to get to not have them being sent to places where they don't belong. That's how I support my troops. How are you supporting your troops? Just blindly going along with the president? He says that that Saddam Hussein and Iraq had a connection to 9/11, and to this day, the polls show that a majority of people do believe that Saddam Hussein had a connection to 9/11, when even the president and his team say it's not true now. They, you know, they haven't been able to. So, you know, he says it there on TV, and it comes out here in these stupid bumper stickers, support our troops. You know, the troops are pawns. And I would also say that, you know, the population of our armed forces, you know, they're human beings, and I'm sure if you polled them, there's a segment of that population who, even back then when they were sent to Iraq, smelled a fish and were thinking to themselves, well, this ain't right. Why am I going here? Certainly now. And, you know, to me, the way you support your troops is if your son has been or daughter has been killed or wounded over there, you don't just shut up and not say anything. If you smell a fish, you get on national TV, and if you want to leave a monument to your son, something that your son, something that will have meaning in your son's name, you'll stand up and say, this man, this president of the United States, sent my son somewhere where he should not be under false pretenses, and he is dead. I'm urging other families of the military to join me. You know, Cindy Sheehan was vilified, but she was, you know, one of the first people to do this, to stand up and say, this is wrong. That is a true memorial to your dead son or daughter, not just clamming up and going along with our president because you don't want to be seen as unpatriotic. So all this is boiling under my skin. And it was on a trip with my wife to Asheville, North Carolina. I remember it clearly. She was driving. I was in the passenger seat. And I pulled out a pad of yellow paper. And in about an hour, I had the lyrics to this song out and on paper. And I also had somewhat of a melody, so I picked up the cell phone and called my own voicemail and hummed a bit of the melody into it. And that was a year and a half to 2 years ago. And I've been sitting on it ever since. And a few months ago, a couple of months ago, as we geared up to the election, well, let me back up a bit. One of the reasons I had not put it out, and I think one of the main reasons that I had not put out any song that I'd written, I just hadn't published it, I hadn't posted anything to the internet, was a fear of what happens when you do cross that line and suddenly you are a public figure and the genie's out of the bottle. You can't put it back in the bottle. And I was afraid, I lived in New York for 5 years, and you know, everybody around me was living there to make it big in the entertainment world or the arts world or whatever. And after 5 years, I realized, you know, the quality of my life is more important than being famous or being rich. So I left New York. And thinking, using that same mode of thinking, I'm saying to myself, Beej, if you do this, if you really start your singer-songwriter career, you're out there. And if you're successful, your life will not get any simpler. It will get more complicated. It will probably be a lot harder. You'll have all these, you know, A, drunks when you play in clubs coming up to you, B, sycophants if you're, you know, very successful who just want to be near B.J. Lederman. And, you know, I'd read enough about how that effect sort of drove the Beatles insane. I mean, literally, George said at the end of the anthology, he said, well, you know, the people, they gave their money and their screams, but we gave our nervous systems. And, you know, I wasn't quite sure whether I wanted to cross that line. But here we are a couple of months before the election, and I just, well, I was going through a divorce with my first divorce with my lovely and beautiful wife, who I love dearly. And somewhere, this process was new to me, and somehow I grew balls that I never had before. And this is probably the best thing that has really happened to me so far in life, is this transformation I'm going through now, where I don't give a shit anymore. I really don't. And I felt also this groundswell, I mean, for Obama. Never mind that he's African American. He could be any color, but what was coming out of that man's mouth were the first words that inspired me in decades. And I was done. I was cooked. I was fried. I was fried for Obama, and what was going on in my personal life, I said, fuck it. And I grabbed my piano. I dragged it to the middle of my living room. I got my cheesy consumer camcorder. I pointed it at myself. I hooked my ass up to Pro Tools, and I recorded this song. And that is what you see on the internet today. History 911, the video with me with the Obama hat on, is the catharsis of all of this bullshit that's been raging inside me about who will be the most damaging, come to be known as the most damaging president the United States has ever had. In fact, hopefully handing off to the most constructive president we've ever had. And I said, fuck it. Let's do it. Let's have a new career. The stars are in alignment. The NPR is going to have their 30th anniversary. Well, after they hear this, they probably won't want anything to do with me, but that's fine. You know, because literally, I don't care. I've got a point of view. I'm going to write the songs. I'm going out on the road. Hail Mary.
Well, what are the early reads from the internet? What kind of feedback have you received from the song being out there now?
I have been delightfully surprised at the response to History 911. I think that, you know, a watershed event, a critical mass has been reached where even, and I don't know whether it's because John McCain led such an awful campaign, and, you know, there are now conservatives who may not agree with my stance, but they're not going to come out and bust a cap in my ass. I think there's been a groundswell of opinion shifting. And so a large majority of the feedback I'm getting is very positive and wonderful. And I think the song is good. You know, it's not Imagine, because it's very, well, because I'm not John, first of all. And, but it is anthemic. And I think it's a history lesson. And it will have legs beyond the presidency of George W. Bush.
Well, I think it's fascinating personally, and I know many others who agree. And from the turnout of the election, I'd say there's a large mandate of individuals out there that also agree with your point of view. So well done.
Thank you very much. Neil Young just added it to his anti-war site called Living with War, LWW.com, I think. Living with War.
That's a strong endorsement.
Maybe I'll meet Mr. Young one day. I love him.
BJ, tell us what's next for you as you embark on the next chapter of your musical career.
I'm going to be recording my first album, debut album, Life at the Bottom of the Dial, or History 911, or National Public Lederman is another possibility.
That works.
And I'll be commencing my public radio tour. I'll be coming to public radio cities and towns and doing concerts there and doing, you know, luncheons, whatever the general manager wants to do, meet the people, meet the donors. And hopefully if there's a venue in town like we have here, the Jewish Mother, it's a very cool place to play. I'd like to stay an extra day and do a concert at there, which would be a little rougher edged and more to the point of who I am and what I want to do. And I will just do that leading up to the 30th anniversary of Morning Edition in next November of 2009. I understand there's going to be some sort of honor. They're going to honor me up there a little bit for my music. So it'd be nice to slowly build up this other career where people are buying my songs and coming out to concerts. My concert, by the way, is going to have this first concert is going to have it's going to kind of be a takeoff on Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth. I'm going to have a little slideshow going on too, to let the people get to know BJ and his life.
I think it sounds fascinating, and I believe it will be successful because you've got such a recognizable name and an interesting story to tell. So I wish you all the luck in the world on that. I think it's going to be neat to watch that happen.
I'm fortunate that I'm making my debut in radio because, boy, do I have a face for radio.
Don't we all?
As always, we hope you enjoyed this week's program. We love to hear your feedback and ideas for future shows. You can reach us via our blog at blog.musicindustryforum.com. Look for our show next week, where we feature a great interview with Bruce Birch, who heads up the UGA Music Business Program. They have a fantastic program going on down there. We're really excited to hear everything that he's got going on. And for now, we're going to leave you with the full version, the jazz version, of the NPR Morning Edition theme, done by BJ Lederman. Thanks so much.